Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Dry Cleaner Cast presents Need to Know. Need to Know is a podcast featuring conversations with security experts focused on the terrorism and intelligence stories dominating the headlines. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr. This is Need to Know.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by author and journalist David Nywert, and we take a look into the conspiracy theories around the coronavirus and how many of those conspiracy theories have their roots in far-right ideology. If you're enjoying this show, please consider becoming a Patreon subscriber. If you go to patreon.com/drycleanercast, you'll get access to new exclusive episodes just for Patreon subscribers. You'll also get early access to our interviews, and if you subscribe at over $15 a month, you'll also get a copy of the film The Dry Cleaner. Also, if you like the show, please leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast app. Every positive review or every review helps us gain more listeners. Also, if you like this podcast, you may enjoy my short film, The Dry Cleaner. The Dry Cleaner is my first attempt at spy fiction, and it is now available on iTunes and Amazon. All you need to do is type in The Dry Cleaner film to iTunes or Amazon, and you'll see the film come up. I think it comes in about $1.99. If you become a Patreon subscriber at over $15, you will get a copy of that film included with your subscription. So you have the choice there. I hope you enjoyed this episode.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
David, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing?
Very good, Chris. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Surviving the all the fun of the lockdown at the moment. Getting a lot of podcasting done, so it's been good.
Yeah, watching tons of movies.
Yes, and movies too. So for the benefit of new listeners, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, well, I'm a longtime journalist. I started in newspapers back in 1978 in Northern Idaho.
Yes.
And I just right then immediately fell into having to cover right-wing extremists, neo-Nazis, because we had at the newspaper I was working at, we had the Aryan Nations, a notorious neo-Nazi organization move in just 20 miles south of where our offices were. So we became intimately familiar with their activities during those years. And they, because it was part of my work as a reporter for most of the years that followed, I just always had a background in them. And then in the 1990s, I decided that when I was first starting up my freelance work, that this was a subject that I really needed to, that was important to focus on and to provide, you know, beat coverage on, because it is a dedicated beat. It's actually such a consistent social issue that I recognized right away that it was going to be providing me with no end of stories for most of my writing career, as indeed it has, and B, it was also it's underrated in its importance.
Yeah.
So I felt it was important to have good journalists who could bring historical and institutional knowledge to the thing, to be, you know, part of the, or to be writing about it. So, back in about 92, I decided to start making this a dedicated beat, and it I was kind of hoping to retire by now, but
yes.
it hasn't worked out that way. So I worked for MSNBC from 96 to 2000, won a National Press Club Award for them. I quit because I was disgusted with the whole business, especially after the Clinton impeachment fiasco. And so I moved, or I became a freelance writer full time and a stay at home dad. That was really my main job, and started blogging pretty early. So I worked for blogs for quite a few years. I wound up writing beginning in 2013 for the Southern Poverty Law Center and their Hate Watch blog. And I did that for 6 years. And then in 2019, I began working for Daily Kos, which is where you can find my work regularly now.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, and you've been covering an awful lot of things on there.
I've written a few books about this.
And you've got a new one coming out soon, haven't you?
Yeah, yes, I do. So my most recent book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, which came out in 2017. And yes, I have a forthcoming book coming out, well, we hope in September, but I don't think it's going to because of the COVID stuff. I'm sure it's screwed up every schedule. But it's about conspiracy theories, and it's titled Red Pill, Blue Pill.
Yeah, perfectly titled there. So brilliant. Well, conspiracy theories, what we're going to chat a little bit about today. So so obviously the coronavirus has led to a lot of understandable concern, and people are sort of turning to the internet for answers about sort of how this happened and what they can do. And the downside to this, as we previously discussed, is that the online world today is a bit of a petri dish that is as toxic to your health as the coronavirus. Without missing a beat, a lot of conspiracy theorists have sort of sensed an opportunity with the coronavirus to make money whilst peddling their beliefs about the pandemic, and in the process kind of confusing people and causing all sorts of chaos. So can you talk to us a little bit about what you sort of discovered about the economics of conspiracy theories, and also how a lot of popular conspiracies have their roots in the far right?
So nowadays, conspiracy theorists make their money through a lot of different means than they did back in the 90s when I was first doing this. Back then, they just had mailing lists and radio shows and hope for donations. Nowadays they can generate money through any number of means. One of their most popular, of course, is to just monetize their videos on YouTube, which YouTube is a real cesspool of conspiracy theories. And there, I mean, just hundreds of people out there on YouTube filing videos about conspiracy theories, and they're all with the hope that they can monetize those videos if they go viral or something like that. They can build an audience. A lot of people also monetize through Patreon and other, you know, sort of fundraiser systems. But I would say the number one way that they make money, and this goes back to the 90s, is through selling phony health cures. You'll notice that one of Alex Jones's favorite side pitches on InfoWars is for his various tinctures and special solutions that he will sell you, including one most recently, the tried to claim would prevent you from being infected by the COVID-19. We've seen a lot of these guys like Mike Adams going out and promoting these colloidal silver solutions. And colloidal silver goes back to the 70s and 80s when I was first doing this. That was part of the conspiracy world that they believed that, you know, well, this is how you fight cancer or whatever, that the FDA was lying to us about cancer cures, and that you really do have these, there are all these various things out there you can do to fight various diseases, and you just need to talk to the right snake oil salesman.
Yeah. Oh, my word. So basically, they're pimping these products online, or they sort of take a cut from it then, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that Jones makes a ton of money off those health supplements. And, of course, he sells T-shirts and everything else. So Jones in particular has figured out, you know, dozens of ways of monetizing his conspiracy theories. But yeah, those are probably the most common and popular. They just have a lot of ways to make money and they do it.
What kind of figures are we dealing with? Because I don't know if I'm right in remembering this, but you know, of Alex Jones's sort of custody battle that came about, was it last year? I saw a figure, and I could be wrong, but it was a figure in the region of something like $8 million per year he earns or something.
Yeah, in 2010, when he was really at the height of his popularity, and between 2010 and 14, I would say, he was making millions of dollars. And a lot of that had to do with the advertising he was generating on his YouTube page, because in addition to monetizing through YouTube, he was, making money. He was actually, I believe, Jones was YouTube's top payout for about 4 or 5 years. He was making millions of dollars on advertising. So. They don't miss a trick. And of course, now recently, I don't know if you caught it this past week, Alex has been contemplating the realities of, you know, the lockdown and what will happen in the COVID era. And like my friends in the Patriot movement who are all on about their Civil War boogaloo, he also is planning for a post-apocalyptic breakdown where he goes and kills his neighbors and eats them. He actually talked about eating his neighbor's ass on his show this week.
He went full Hannibal Lecter.
My kids are not going to die. If it comes down to that, I'm going to kill my neighbors and feed them to my kids, he said.
I mean, I know there's a shortage of flour and pasta at the moment, but that's pretty extreme.
Yeah, well, it was probably the ultimate expression of what we're seeing with the whole response to the COVID lockdown from these folks. Because they are talking about engaging in a civil war, but it's not just that they're going to take down authorities. They're actually talking about invading their neighbors and killing them for their toilet paper.
Well, that segue is quite interesting into, you know, we're seeing a worrying rise in people who've been following conspiracy theories, who have actually sort of participated in quite dangerous actions. And obviously we've got the groups of armed men protesting about the lockdown. You've got people setting fire to 5G telephone masts. And you've also got this train driver in LA who intentionally derailed a train recently as well. So what are your thoughts on this? And you've already mentioned it briefly, there's this thing about this term boogaloo that's quite significant with a lot of what's going on.
Well, the radical right, as you know, Chris, has fantasized about having a race war or a second civil war in America for a very long time. This goes back to the 70s and 80s when William Pierce wrote the Turner Diaries, which was about a race war, civil war. And that book, of course, inspired not just the Order, the neo-Nazi gang that committed a series of horrific crimes in the 80s, but also Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, the Oklahoma bomber.
He was a Turner Diaries fan. And the Turner Diaries is still widely read among neo-Nazis today. So, this is a notion that has been around for a very long time, but it's really been gaining steam in the last 5-6 years. Michael Savage, the right-wing radio commentator, wrote a whole book about how we're headed towards a civil war. And And of course, they actually look forward to this civil war, because it's when they start talking about it on social media, it's all the discussion is about, oh, well, we can start killing those liberals we hate without any compunction. It's almost literally the level of discussion that it's at.
Yeah.
So this has been floating around for a long time. And beginning in 2018, mostly talking about it as a defense of Donald Trump, they began talking about this civil war using the term boogaloo. This arose from a neo-Nazi's post on Reddit. He was the first person to use the term. It was a typical alt-right irony. They're using the name from a bad 1982 disco movie called Break Into Electric Boogaloo, is what the movie was titled. But it's just their typical irony stuff. And the idea of the boogaloo is that they're going to, be engaging in this. Well, now that we're in the lockdown here in the States, the boogaloo boys, as they call themselves, are just going completely ape. And they're all over. And you see them at these rallies. Mm. These are the guys wearing the Hawaiian shirts when you see at the rallies. If you're confused by the appearance of Hawaiian shirts under body armor and AR-15s at these rallies, that's what this is about. These are guys who are eager and willing and absolutely desirous of fomenting a civil war in the United States. And they want to start shooting people. And they talk about it. And they talk about not just, like I say, not just killing politicians. They talk about invading their neighbors and stealing their toilet paper after they kill them. So, I mean, it's, they think this stuff's all very funny, of course, because that's typical right-wing extremist humor.
Well, yeah, I mean, like with any extremist group, so their goal is to, in a sense, break down society so they can rebuild it in their image, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Put it in more anodyne terms, these are folks who really are hoping to replace liberal democracy with a fascist authoritarian system, a white nationalist authoritarian system. And they're pretty unapologetic about it. They don't do these things publicly, mind you. They all hide behind pseudonyms and they guard their anonymity religiously, because, of course, if it got out that, your local bank clerk is one of the people doing paramilitary exercises on the weekend, they're going to lose their jobs. So,
so they guard their
identities quite zealously, but they're all busy talking about the boogaloo. Interestingly, one of the people here in Western Washington State, who is an outspoken promoter of the boogaloo concept, is the guy who runs the, it's called 3% of Washington. It's a militia organization. It's based down in rural town of Eatonville, which is right at the base of Mount Rainier. And the guy who runs it, Matt Marshall, is, you'll see him, in fact, on my Daily Coast post about these guys doing the boogaloo. You'll see a photo of him leading the protest in Olympia, Washington, with a Hawaiian shirt. Marshall is also a member of the Eatonville School Board, and he's running for the state legislature in his district. And so, yeah, and he's taking on the guy who's the current Republican House Minority Leader.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't think he'll do well, but, these guys are all, they're really about, in many ways, trying to mainstream their ideas and their beliefs. And Marshall likes to claim, oh, we're not really about violence. The boogaloo isn't about violence or hate or white supremacy. It's just about defending our gun rights. And then you go to the Then you go to the Facebook pages. There are 125 Facebook pages, by the way, devoted to the Boogaloo, and Facebook has no interest in removing them. And they have some of the most vile stuff you'll ever see. And it's all rather disturbing and frightening because, yeah, it's all about killing politicians and killing their fellow Americans.
Yeah. So fun. That's basically exploiting the situation at the moment to try and hopefully bring in new sort of supporters through the fears of the coronavirus and things like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, you've seen the photos of LA. Mm. It's totally abandoned. You've seen our city streets just abandoned. And honestly, it has America right now definitely has like a sort of post-apocalyptic feel to it because everything is so shut down. And that just enhances what they're doing, of course, is playing with that apocalyptic fears. Because as you know, I mean, most of these conspiracy theories are fundamentally built around these sort of apocalyptic beliefs, right? Mm. The end of the world is coming. Well, when it actually kind of looks like the end of the world is coming, these guys get a lot more recruitment going.
Yeah, well, this is it. I you see things like with conspiracy theorists, they talk about either it's the globalist elite are somehow engineering this, or it's the apocalypse, which sort of leads into kind of biblical references and things like that. It's quite an interesting kind of potpourri of references they use.
Oh, yeah, they use all kinds. I mean, that's the thing about the modern right is that it's not like, well, it's nothing like the old radical right that I used to cover in the 80s and 90s. Those guys were all very backward looking. They had no sense of humor and no, I mean, there's nothing ironic about them at all. They were just dead, dull, serious, kind of stolid and not terribly bright about it. And the modern radical right is very smart, very agile, really deploys the use of social references in very clever ways. They're very smart about recruiting because they're recruiting, you know, the old right used to mostly recruit old guys. You know, I mean, that was when I would go to these meetings, it was mostly a bunch of old white guys. You know, very rarely would you see young men. And nowadays that's all it is. It's, you know, I mean, the recruitment is between the ages of 13 and 30. Young white males, that's who they're going for. And that's who I see the very large mass of at these demonstrations and marches and the people participating in this alt-right craziness.
Yeah, definitely. It's very worrying. So one question I must ask is then, what has President Trump's reaction been to these groups protesting these necessary lockdown measures?
He calls them great people. These are great people. They're just got cabin fever, he says, and they just want to go back to work. They just want to get back on with their lives. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, talk to the virus, dude. talk to the virus, because that's who's setting this agenda. It isn't the government. And that's the thing, is that they're mistaking the government for the virus.
Mm.
And the government wants to take away my liberties. No, I'm afraid this virus is taking away your liberties, and we won't have our liberties in full range until we are able to defeat this virus.
Yeah.
Virus doesn't respect your constitutional rights. It doesn't respect your free speech rights. It doesn't respect your freedom to assemble. It only respects that it can that if you give enough distance, it can't contaminate other people. That's the only thing it respects.
Yeah. One quick question that comes to mind as well. A lot of these kind of conspiracy groups and these militia groups at the moment, they somehow see Trump as their man in the White House. Yet, what I don't quite get is then they're kind of protesting against measures he's putting in place. But are they kind of somehow thinking that he's what is the logic behind
that? I mean, it's all coming. They all have Trump banners and they're wearing MAGA hats at these protests. And because partly because they're not actually protesting Trump's measures, they're protesting the governor's measures.
Okay.
And so all of the protests are against the governors, and they're, you know, like showing signs with nooses on them saying "Hang Whitmer" and things like this, or all of this is being generated and focused on governors, particularly Democratic governors in blue states, because that's who Trump is. And Trump's actually been kind of pointing to them in his comments and on Twitter. And so he's really creating targets in many ways for the radical right to hate on. And so, the anti-lockdown protests have all been heavily pro-Trump.
Yeah.
They don't see him as responsible for the lockdown measures. They see these Democratic governors as being responsible for them.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes a bit more sense. But anyway, in that kind of weird twisted logic. But yeah. Okay. So with the COVID outbreak, conspiracy theories are obviously now being seen as a public health concern, I think rightly so. And social media companies such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have started to take a bit more of a proactive stance against conspiracy theorists, but obviously there's still exceptions to that. And a recent example that comes to mind is YouTube pulled a live stream of David Icke being interviewed about his conspiratorial views on COVID. And then since his removal from YouTube, David Icke has become painted as a victim of corporate and government censorship. What are your thoughts on that, and how best to tackle kind of conspiracy theories online and this sort of nonsense information that's going on out there?
Well, you know, free speech has never permitted people to, the rules of free speech have never permitted people to yell fire in a crowded theater. What Icke is doing, has been doing essentially, is essentially the same thing. He's spreading disinformation and misinformation about public health during a pandemic, during a national crisis. And so I believe it's not only is it responsible for the media, for these social media to remove him, it's really the only responsible thing to do, because you can't be platforming information that is going to get people killed. And that's what Icke has been doing. And all of the people who are claiming that the coronavirus is caused by 5G towers, and said, I think you've had, 20 towers set on fire in the UK?
Yeah.
And also there have been some in the Netherlands. And even there have even been fires set down in, I believe it's Nigeria.
Oh, wow.
The conspiracy theory has spread so far that it's become this international phenomenon. Oddly enough, nobody's setting 5G towers on fire in the U.S. I don't know why, because the conspiracy theory here is one, the popular one on the coronavirus is not about 5G. It's about Bill Gates, actually.
Oh, yeah. What is the origins of that one? That's a weird one. This sort of Bill Gates Foundation conspiracy theory, where he's somehow making money out of the cure or something.
Yeah, well, it's very closely associated with the theories that still, I think, are being spread by President Trump, that the coronavirus was actually produced in a laboratory in Wuhan. I think it might have actually been Alex Jones or one of his associates who first came up with this theory that, well, that lab in Wuhan was actually financed by the Gates Foundation, and so therefore the Gates Foundation is responsible for has actually been creating this coronavirus as a bioweapon to use against Americans. And of course, I'm sure that the folks in Milan will be very interested to have heard that. But,
yes. No, it's crazy, isn't it? But it does sound very Alex Jones-like.
He certainly circulated the theory. I don't know that he originated it.
No. Well, that's the interesting thing with a lot of conspiracy theories too, because we've never talked much about between us about Russian disinformation, but obviously at the moment there are disinformation campaigns that are state-sponsored going on with regards to the coronavirus. There's a Russian one, there's a Chinese one. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of an official American government campaign, but it does seem to be a Trump supporter campaign going on. And it is a real interesting mishmash of different things, but it does seem to be this sort of weird ecosystem that I noticed when I was in my conspiracy theory days of information started to trickle in from Russian sources like Russia Today and things like that were becoming popular, and people I knew in the conspiracy movement ended up on Russia Today and so on. I don't know if there's anything you've observed.
Yeah, well, Russia was definitely one of the big promoters of the 5G theories, partly because there seems to be Russian state hostility to 5G because they see it's actually a competitive, it's an economic competitive thing. Putin sees the Chinese moving ahead with 5G and sees himself falling at an economic disadvantage. So they've been promoting 5G is a health threat theories for what, 2-3 years now? I know that RT and Russian sources have been major fonts of this misinformation or disinformation. And in particular, lately now, the claims that it's part of the coronavirus pandemic have also been, you know, very popular on RT as well. RT is just a cesspool. And anyone who watches it or listens to it or gives it any credence whatsoever is a fool, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. One quick thing actually is interesting, and this will lead nicely into our next area of discussion in a moment, but I've noticed that the 5G conspiracy theory that's been going on for a while now, and obviously now recently links to coronavirus, is very popular among certain kind of environmental groups and new age people as well. And I don't know if there's anything you've seen with that at all.
Yeah. When I was diving into the whole 5G conspiracy theory, it was clear that there were a lot of folks who were engaged in this on basically sort of a health and environmental claim perspective, and that was what their sites mostly dealt with. You know, these are the same folks that run pictures of dolphins at a port in Italy and that were taken 6 months ago and claim that, nature is returning. And we've had a bunch of the, nature is reviving itself stuff going on during the pandemic that is actually not related at all to any factual thing, but is actually, these are being produced by what we call eco-fascists. Eco-fascists are basically people, neo-Nazis who use environmental and climate change type arguments to argue for basically destroying liberal democracy. You know, it's a sort of side function of accelerationism. Do you know what accelerationism is?
No, what's accelerationism?
Well, it's a sort of component of neo-Nazi thought. Particularly popular among the very young people who are extremely nihilistic. They call it getting blackpilled, but basically it's human beings are bad for the planet, we've destroyed the world, and we should actually try to help things along by accelerating the demise of civilization. So do what we can to help nature by helping to destroy human civilization. And that's exactly what a lot of these guys are doing. So, eco-fascists are, they argue against immigration on ecological grounds, and they argue against race mixing on ecological grounds, what have you. You know, there's just, and they blame the death, climate change on the Jews, all these things. So these folks have been very active. I think there were some flyers put up there in, you know, part of England, and they were saying, yes, nature is returning. Humans are the the disease and the virus is the cure. The flyer, and claiming to be Extinction Rebellion, but of course Extinction Rebellion immediately said, no, we have nothing to do with this. But this is typical of fascists, that they'll just they will use any little wedge, they will use any little opening they can to try to recruit people.
Yeah, and one of the things that is interesting with these eco-fascists, because just what you've described with the, was it called acceleration theory, is that what it was?
Yeah,
because I've seen that certainly in expressed in the past, at looking at things like InfoWars and things like that and back in the day, and I remember when I was a conspiracy theorist, one of the popular things among the people I was hanging out with was this, and it was partly from David Icke, I believe, this idea that it was all, the climate change was all a great hoax, was one of the popular theories then, and obviously you see that with
Would
the
you
kind
make
of
yeah,
I know that's the interesting thing about conspiracy theories, is that the greatest problem is actually knowing what the actual conspiracy is, because there's so many versions of it. And it's just like this, and that's why it kind of endures, I think, because, and that's why it's almost very hard to argue a conspiracy theorist, because if you take down one argument, they move on to the next one. Well, if it's not that, it's this, and so on and so on.
Yeah,
and I can see eco-fascism and some of those things. I can see that appealing to, some of the environmental side of what they talk about, sort of appealing to genuine environmentalists. And it's very interesting how these different sort of groups out there, how they all have something that somehow appeals to another group who's completely diametrically opposed to fascism, but somehow then they end up echoing kind of fascist ideas. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's
and worrying.
You know, after a while, you need to go take a long hot bath, get yourself out of that mind, because it can be really, as you know, living in this, operating in this sphere gets. Can really be taxing on a normal person mentally, because it's so bewildering and so toxic and so ugly in so many ways that it gets to be depressing. But hey, we got to find some humor in it somehow. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a Dry Cleaner Cast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. That's patreon.com/drycleanercast.
One of the interesting ideas behind eco-fascism, which I picked up on your article, as the effects of global warming are going to get more pronounced maybe in the next 10 to 20 years, and we're going to see more catastrophes of the nature that we're experiencing right now, so you're going to have more movement of sort of refugees and things like that. And these groups have this idea of something called the Great Replacement. Obviously, world events, they're going to try and sort of frame them through this Great Replacement sort of idea. So can you talk to us a bit about what the Great Replacement is?
Sure. Well, the Great Replacement theory is kind of a mutation of earlier cultural Marxism theories, which were that cultural Marxism is this idea that a sacred cabal of Jews have been silently and nefariously controlling Western civilization through cultural means, that, you know, it basically is anything, feminism, liberalism, environmentalism, these are all products of this nefarious Jewish conspiracy to enslave and destroy Western white civilization. And immigration, of course, is one of the main ways that they complain about, that they blame on cultural Marxism. So the Great Replacement Theory, or the replacement theory based on the book The Great Replacement by a man named, unfortunately, Camus. The last name was Camus. Published his book in 2011-12, I think it was, in French. It was basically a takeoff, sort of adaptation of cultural Marxism, where he argued essentially that all of the mass immigration that is taking place around the world, both in Europe and the United States, is part of this nefarious plot to replace. They basically intend to replace white people with brown immigrants as voters and as, you know, the political base of the world. And that white people are going to be replaced by these immigrants. And we get this stuff, you know, it has spread extremely widely. It's obviously extremely popular among the neo-Nazi and radical right, but it has spread to very much mainstream venues. Tucker Carlson has promoted replacement theory on his show. And there have been several other mainstream sources that have used it. And of course, it has inspired mass killings. The Christchurch killer was someone who referenced great replacement theory in his manifesto and was obviously familiar with it. The El Paso killer was also another man who he very specifically mentions replacement theory, and I think he mentions Camus. So, these guys, so this theory is actually inspiring mass murders, but it is also weaseling its way into mainstream conservative thought, which is rapidly, just as the years go on, is increasingly, resembling fascist thought.
Yeah. And so then eco-fascists are kind of using this idea as the underpinning of their beliefs, aren't they? And I was just looking at my notes and I noticed these eco-fascists like to use a term deep ecology.
Yeah.
To describe themselves.
Well, actually deep ecology is an older concept that has to do with it's basically a misanthropic approach to environmentalism, but at the end of the day, it becomes fascist.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who, and I've known people who were into deep ecology and didn't understand that they were heading down that path.
Yeah. I can imagine, because that's the thing, when, if you remove the racial context to it from an, because I've spoken to many environmentalists who kind of start going down a slightly wacky road with the idea of the planet's overpopulated and things like that, and it starts getting into rather icky territory.
Yeah. Let's just have a little genocide to solve the problem, right?
Yeah, and I think the thing is, people just,
there's that pandemic.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who hold some of these beliefs don't realize how far those beliefs can go, and how, you know, and it's because quite a few environmentalists I've met are a bit, to put it politely, divorced of reality a little bit. I mean, I know somebody in particular who's now living in a mountain in an undisclosed location just to get away from COVID. And and it's just, I just find some of them are a little bit, I can see them as easy prey for these ideas.
Yes, absolutely. No, if you're not rigorous in your thinking about this, you're going to be very susceptible to all of these ideas. I've been thinking about how we deal with this going forward. How do we educate young people to be immune to this conspiracism and this bad information and this misinformation? How do you get people to where they're not as susceptible? And a lot of it just really has to do with, in the end, you have to be, you have to hold, factual truth as a real value, and that expertise has real value, and all of these things, instead of just discarding them. And, it's going to take what we've called digital literacy. Too many people get online and just absorb the information that they're receiving, rather than actually knowledgeably separating the wheat from the chaff. And it's been very easy for me, because I was a copy editor, I was a news editor for a long time, And a lot of my job had to do with separating the wheat from the chaff and being able to figure out what was factual and what wasn't. So for me, it comes naturally, and I know it doesn't come naturally for most people. But there's a lot of work going around now, coming out now about how do we improve digital literacy so that when someone comes across one of these conspiracy theories, they can quickly ascertain whether or not it actually is factual or whether it's just a farce. And most of the time, it's actually easier to figure out than you think. But yeah.
Do you have any tips for the audience, just as a trained journalist stuff? How do you kind of find facts? How do you sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, as you say?
Well, a lot of it just has to do with the nature of the substantiation. So if these facts come from, for example, published peer-reviewed studies, it has a very high likelihood of being an actual fact. If a news fact comes from eyewitnesses who were there on the ground and are able to relate, events as they actually occurred in a factual manner, then that's a lot different than, that's totally different from somebody who watched a video and posts their interpretation of it, And so basically, I think that, some of the simplest tips are just when you come across it on a website, a conspiracy theory on a website, go and actually look at the rest of that website. Don't just look at the article that you're being directed to, because a lot of times conspiracy theorists will post semi-legitimate stuff on their page to draw you into their website, and then they sell you a bunch of other conspiracy theories while they're at it. And you may not know it, but actually the conspiracy theories are embedded within that story that attracted you in the first place. So go look at one of the best ways of, sort of checking your information is to contextualize it within the website that you're looking at itself. And you can usually tell by looking at the other content on a website what its direction and purpose is. And once you understand that, then you actually understand the context of what that story is that you've been reading. So that's one of the best techniques I can offer.
Yeah. I had a run-in with an old conspiracy acquaintance of mine on Facebook, which thankfully ended in him unfriending me. Thank God. finally. And he was saying things like, don't read the news because it's bad for your health. And then says something about, do you trust the BBC and things like that? How do you kind of...
I don't innately trust the New York Times. I mean, this is the thing, is that understanding that even authoritative sources can be wrong is an important nuance that you don't just blindly give yourself over to the sources, but you do examine, you can actually examine the individual stories and also critique them. And you can also, let's just think about New York Times and its role in the Iraq War. Right. It basically sold Americans on this idea that there were weapons of mass destruction, because it was a willing conduit for government disinformation from the Bush administration. And so many of us still keep that in mind when we go to read the New York Times, that, yes, the New York Times can be wrong and Washington Post can be wrong. All of these authoritative sources can be wrong. And even if you feel with a degree of confidence that something you're reading is factual, always keep in mind that, it also could turn out to be wrong. But this is, you do have to make, everybody has to make choices based on the best information they have available. But it has to be the best information. It can't be just any information, It has to be actually good, sound information if you're going to act on it. It's just like, do you believe Donald Trump or do you believe Dr. Fauci? I believe Dr. Fauci because I know I know who's actually authoritative, right? And on the other hand, I'm not really eager to inhale that bleach in the first damn place. You know?
Do you know what? I mean, honestly, that whole bleach thing. I mean, my dark humor, every time I see somebody mentioning it, I just have to put Darwin because it's sort of getting to that point now where if people are really, it's you know, honestly, it's
not always even that because what actually, of course, happens is that the people who are succumbing to what we would consider natural selection by being stupid, you know, classic Dunning-Kruger syndrome stuff here. They aren't always just harming themselves. Take, for instance, the couple that, remember that couple that actually consumed hydrochloroquine? They found the fish tank cleaner. This is a couple of they found the fish tank cleaner. They had hydrochloroquine, after Trump promoted it, and then they both wound up deathly ill, and the husband died because they took it. Well, it turned out later that the husband didn't know he was taking it. His wife is just put it in his soda, along with hers. She thought she was doing both of them a favor.
Yeah,
and of course he died from it. But this is why conspiracy theories are lethal, because the people around them are so stupid that they will harm the people that are around them.
Well, yeah, and this is what concerns me a bit about the anti-vax movement as well, because obviously in time, hopefully, there's going to be a vaccine for the coronavirus, but there's going to be this whole history of the anti-vax movement that's going to kind of collide with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've already spoken to people about this, and they're like, oh, I'm not going to take a vaccine. It's going to make me go blind. It's like, well, hang on a minute. Yeah. They haven't even made the vaccine yet. How do you know it's going to make you go blind? You know?
Well, this is part of the Bill Gates thing, you know, that actually the plot, that Bill Gates' nefarious plot isn't just to arm red states. It's actually to get everybody to use this vaccine. To have to use the vaccine. And the vaccine is going to come with a chip, a microchip. You're only going to be able to get the vaccine if you have a microchip implanted under your skin.
Yeah.
And so this is,
And that's been a popular conspiracy theory, the microchip thing. Because I remember, here's another conspiracy tale. I remember once I went for some random dinner with some random people, and I just had an operation, and the host of this party, I don't know how we ended up talking about I had an operation. I think a friend of mine was like, oh, Chris has just come from hospital. And the host was sort of disgusted by the fact that I've just recently been to hospital, because apparently, without my knowledge, I've been implanted with a microchip. And it's like, it's that kind of mentality. So the thing is, thankfully, the hospital visit wasn't that serious. It wasn't life-threatening. But the thing is, if I had had something life-threatening and I took what she said to heart, I didn't have common sense, people might not go to hospital with serious conditions because they're scared of this microchip. Yep. It's so dangerous, isn't it?
Well, or they won't take the vaccine, and so they're going to continue spreading COVID to the rest of the nation.
Yeah. But just before we wrap up, I did want to just touch briefly upon the rise of hate crimes towards Asian Americans and people of Asian appearance. I mean, just in the weeks before the lockdown, I remember in London there were reports of people who were physically distancing themselves from anybody who looked Asian, and it was disgusting. What's the situation at the moment in the States with regards to Asian Americans?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's that we're having a tide of it. It's not a huge groundswell, but we are seeing a steady flow of hate crime incidents targeting Asian Americans. There was a Brooklyn man and his 6-year-old daughter, Chinese, who were assaulted, I think, 2 days ago by somebody who thought they, just because they were Chinese, they had the virus. And so there is a fair amount of, it's just basically Trump-bred ignorance, because Trump and the right have been eagerly blaming China for all of this, and the way this gets translated among the, shall we say, less perceptive members of the Trump base is that, oh, Chinese people all have the COVID. You know, that's how this plays out. So Asian American groups are very working very hard to try to pull this back, but unfortunately Republicans are really hell-bent on trying to blame China for the virus as a way of deflecting blame from Trump, so we're probably going to get a lot more ethnic Chinese bashing over the next 6 months as well.
Well, yeah, my suspicion, I could be wrong here, but my suspicion in the build-up to the election, I think Trump's going to ride off an anti-China card, is my suspicion.
I think too many people in this country have died for him to be able to pull this off. I don't think he's going to be able to blame someone else for this, only among his authoritarian followers. And I would be surprised if by November, fully a quarter to a third of his followers will have contracted this disease as well.
Which is it? Once everybody's had some sort of first-hand experience with it, one would hope, and I don't mean wishing people ill, by the way. I mean, just like, yeah. I mean, like, for example, in my own situation, I know people whose parents have died from this, or there are people I follow online, have even past guests on this show have contracted the coronavirus, or relatives of theirs passed away. So even in my own, you know, limited experience of it, I've had some experience with it and spoken to people who've had people close to them die because of it. So I think it will make it harder, definitely, for the BS. I hope it makes it harder for the BS. I really do.
I am kind of curious, since you're closer to it, you know, what effect having contracted it seems to have had on your prime minister. Is he a little more sympathetic to the NHS these days, or
I think it's too early to say. I don't know. I because, you know, Boris Johnson and his whole, you know, his whole government or administration have been very anti the NHS. You know, and they're slowly been trying to sell it off and privatize it and so on. It's been something the Conservatives have wanted to do for a long time. So I don't know. I think politically, because I think the NHS is almost now on par with the Battle of Britain pilots in this country. Yeah. So I think for any politician to do anything significant that damages the NHS now, I think would be political suicide. I could be wrong, but I think it would be, and I hope it would be. Because this is the thing, when you have a situation like this, you realize, I mean, I don't know what the situation is in the States, but if I were, God forbid, or anybody I know, to contract the coronavirus, you know, I would go into hospital, have treatments and come out the other end. And the thing that would have paid for it were my taxes. I wouldn't get a massive medical bill for the ambulance ride, the ventilator time, the bed space. I mean, what is the average cost of somebody in the States who catches the coronavirus? It must be, and you end up hospitalized. It must be quite a lot of money, especially if you don't have medical insurance.
Right. If you're uninsured, it's astronomical and it will bankrupt you. If you have insurance, it depends on your insurance plan, but typically, a stay at a hospital like that would cost you $5,000 to $10,000.
Yeah. And if you're unemployed, and I'm assuming a lot of people's insurance is tied to their employment, there's a lot of people at risk at the moment to lose a lot of money.
It's just a brutal, ugly situation. And people are doing their best, but they're not being helped by the people who are not.
And I know, because, you know, I've spoken to Americans over the years about the NHS, and because many Americans are semi-confused or puzzled by it, and partly because you know, the NHS or public healthcare is kind of painted as some sort of weird backdoor creep to full-on communism in America.
Right.
And it's, and I can tell you from a country that has the NHS, has a public healthcare, it really isn't the backdoor to full-blown communism. And I'm not a fan of communism.
What you're looking at there is that during the Cold War, especially, British-style healthcare was painted as being basically just Soviet medical care light.
Mm.
Like, you know, it's because, you know, the Soviet medical care system was notoriously bad for especially staying on top of, you know, being able to treat people with rare diseases and getting advanced treatment because, you know, it was just not... it wasn't a first world system necessarily at the time. It actually has probably gotten better since then. But yeah, Americans have this image of British, the British healthcare system as being, Soviet-like. As being, you know, well, yeah, you have to wait, you know, have to wait 6 months to see your doctor and you get crappy care and all this kind of stuff. So, and of course, it has nothing to do with the reality. And we actually have an even better, you know, a closer example up in Canada, a very similar system, and it works beautifully. So, you know, during the Obama years, when we were having the healthcare debate, and people would say, I don't want socialism here. It's going to destroy us. Yeah. And I said, oh, you mean socialism like Canada?
Do you know, just that reminds me, so it brings me back to a conference. I remember having another run-in with a former conspiracy theorist, because I seem to have that a lot. A former close friend of mine, I remember during the Obama years, so Obamacare, and I think I remember at the time, people like Alex Jones and David Icke were claiming Obamacare was some sort of form of euthanasia.
Run by the lizard
people, yeah. Yeah, I just like, goodness. But it is the interesting thing I found with conspiracy theories, that one of the things that I think in the end helped me get past, it was I sort of saw how it was connected to very right-wing views and very right-wing politics. And it was quite, once you sort of see it that way, you start to really kind of almost decode it a little bit and start to see through it. And so when you, so Obama's in power and Obamacare's coming up. So what happens? Alex Jones publishes something about Obamacare and how it's terrible. And it is just fascinating. I've always been, you know, I've always been intrigued about the food chain of that information, where it originally stems, you know, these conspiracy theories kind of stem from, and it's just so bizarre. And obviously with your book, with the far right connection, and obviously as we've discovered a little bit about Russian misinformation, we get some ideas of where this stuff comes from and the agendas behind it. It's truly fascinating.
Yeah, part of it has to do with that right-wing politics are fundamentally authoritarian. And authoritarianism requires blind following. It requires people who are willing and able to are actually constitutionally inclined to discard factual information. And conspiracy theories are all about cultivating that mindset where the authorities are all lying to you. Any official story is false, and the only story that you really should believe is the one we tell you.
Mm.
And inevitably, the story that they tell you is a very right-wing one, you know, because it's all about supporting. I mean, didn't anybody ever notice that nobody ever concocted a conspiracy theory about Donald Trump actually being a creature of the New World Order, being cooked up in a lab in Vladimir Putin's Russia somewhere? I mean, that's normally what happens to any kind of liberal politician who shows up.
Well, yeah, Obama, the sleeper Muslim, yeah.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton, too, was the same way. You know, he was the creature of the New World Order and the United Nations back in the 90s. So, yeah, no, this is how it always works. It's always anybody who is basically a supporter of liberal democracy and open society is attacked, because what conspiracy theories ultimately are about is providing an information support system for authoritarianism.
And they want to break basically the one thing that seems to unite all the conspiracy theories I've come across and all the different groups who believe them. There seems to be a sort of goal of disruption and a goal of sort of tearing down the system, quote unquote, and rebuilding it. And it, both the, you know, the environmentalist one, the anti-vaxxers, the far left conspiracy theorists, because there are far left ones and the far right ones, and then the people in between all that, they all seem to just ultimately want to somehow disrupt the system or take it apart and rebuild it in some way. A lot of them don't know how they want to rebuild it, but
yeah, they leave that to the imagination, don't they?
But there we go. Well, look, David, before I let you go, do you have any sort of final thoughts? Do you have anything that we've discussed today that are important to you?
Main thing that people need to understand is that, like, these protests in the United States that we're seeing are really, they kind of really represent the way, I mean, it seems like it's very now and very recent, very Trumpian, but these people that are out there marching have actually been very carefully cultivated by the mainstream right for a very long time. Mm. People need to remember that the Tea Party was originally financed by people like the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity and these right-wing money groups that created the events. And some of these same groups were involved in organizing the anti-lockdown protests, but they didn't have, but unlike in 2009 and 10, when they had to put a lot of money and effort and into organizing these events, this time around, all they had to do was kind of create a sort of structure for them, provide them a template, and it just spread like a virus among the radical right. And so we had, I think, what, 60 anti-lockdown protests this last week. And most of them were not really financed by AFP or Koch brothers or DeVos family, which is what happened in that first week or so of these. No, these are, people are all just, they're just, they've managed to generate this army of authoritarian foot soldiers that is willing and eager to go out there and even make themselves sick in order to Donald Trump. I think it bodes very badly for what's going to happen over the next year as we head into election. So I think Americans need to be ready for likelihood of domestic terrorist violence in this year. And I think liberals and liberal politicians in particular need to take extra steps to provide better security for themselves, because I think these guys are going to be coming for them. Had a QAnon fanatic just last week been arrested. She was live streaming her cross-country trip because she was going to go assassinate Joe Biden. And the police arrested her, you know, midway through her live stream. QAnon folks are particularly crazy. But all of them are, it's going to be something else. I mean, we already had the we called him the MAGA bomber, you know, Cesar Sayoc, the guy who sent out pipe bombs to all of these liberal media and politicians. I think there's going to be a lot more of that.
That's deeply worrying. Well, David, thank you so much for your time today. So where can listeners sort of find out more about you and your work?
Well, my daily work is available at dailycos.com, K-O-S, and I've got a fresh piece, in fact, on this very subject that I hope folks can go and look at. You can also find me on Twitter, of course, under my name. That's N-E-I-W-E-R-T. Yeah, and then catch me occasionally on Chris's show.
Yes, thank you. I do appreciate you coming on regularly now. I think you might be my most featured guest now, I think. I need to double check and look, but maybe somebody could tweet at me and tell me, but I think you are. So thank you for coming on so many times.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter @DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a Dry Cleaner Cast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. That's patreon.com/drycleanercast. Thanks for listening. This is Need to Know.